Well, hello. And we begin this session, Chapter 9, Memory, Ego, and Self-Experience in Book 2 of The Life Divine. It was an essay that first appeared in the Arya on 15 January 1917, when Sri Aurobindo recast The Life Divine. He partially revised this chapter, as he did virtually everything. So we'll find some differences in the text, as in the Arya, as versus here in the book. We won't draw much attention to them. He begins with some citations drawn from Vedic and Vedantic sources, Prashna Upanishad, Mahopanishad, and the Rig Veda. The first is from the Prashna, and you'll probably see that it recalls a theme that we saw him build upon in an earlier chapter where he drew from citations from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. And those were in the fourth book and the third chapter, verses 7 all the way up to 18, I think, would be relevant to the subject that he's addressing here. This is the Prashna. Here, this God, Deva, the mind, in its dream experiences, Swapne, again and again, what once was experienced. What has been seen and what has not been seen, what has been heard and what has not been heard, what has been experienced and what has not been experienced, what is and what is not, all it sees, it is all and sees. So this text, referring to the self which is behind, which peers into the play of existence through the vehicle of the mind. The next one is from the Maho Upanishad, the Maha Upanishad, and from a little-known text. People generally read 12 or 13 of the principal Upanishads and ignore the rest. Here's one in which we have a direct reference to ego, so Sri Aurobindo pulls it into our consideration here. To dwell in our true being is liberation. The sense of ego is a fall from the truth of our being. And the last goes all the way back to the 10th mandala of the Rig Veda. One in many births, a single ocean, Eka Samudra, holder of all streams of movement, sees our hearts. So this idea of an underlying ocean of consciousness, of which the superficial play might be construed as an ego movement, but never displaces the ocean in its entirety. And that is our real being. So Sri Aurobindo begins from this. The direct self-consciousness of the mental being, that by which it becomes aware of its own nameless and formless existence behind the flow of a differentiated self-experience, of its eternal soul substance, behind the mental formations of that substance, of its self behind the ego, goes behind mentality to the timelessness of an eternal present. It is that in it which is ever the same and unaffected by the mental distinction of past, present, and future. So it is mind that becomes aware of the self behind. He continues, it is also unaffected by the distinctions of space or of circumstance. For if the mental being ordinarily says of itself, I am in the body, I am here, I was there, I shall be elsewhere, yet when it learns to fix itself in this direct self-consciousness, it very soon perceives that this is the language of its changing self-experience, which only expresses the relations of its surface consciousness to the environment and to externalities. So there is a context of the superficial self existing in the confluence of time and space. That is not all that it is. That is its self-experience in the surface consciousness. Distinguishing these, detaching itself from these, it perceives that the self of which it is directly conscious does not in any way change by these outward changes, but is always the same, unaffected by the mutations of the body or of the mentality or of the field in which these move and act. It is, in its essence, featureless, relationless, without any other character than that of pure conscious existence, self-sufficient and eternally satisfied with pure being, self-blissful. Thus, we become aware of the stable self, the eternal am, or rather, the immutable is, without any category of personality or time. So again, we wind up speaking of Satchitananda and how mind can have access to the nature of its real being through direct awareness of phenomena. But this consciousness of self, as it is timeless, so is capable also of freely regarding time as a thing reflected in it and as either the cause or the subjective field of a changing experience. It is then the eternal I am, the unchanging consciousness on whose surface changes of conscious experience occur in the process of time. This has resonance all the way back to the philosophy of Abhinavagupta 1,000 years ago, that there is a primary experience of self, aham, I am, which is not the superficial time-bound circumstance-located self, but is supernal, which is beyond, in which all phenomena exist, all instantiations of seeming selfhood exist within that great self. So this philosophy of Abhinavagupta bears striking resemblance to Sri Aurobindo in some of its primary insights. The surface consciousness, Sri Aurobindo says here, is constantly adding to its experience or rejecting from its experience, and by every addition it is modified, and by every rejection also it is modified. Although that deeper self, which supports and contains this mutation, remains unmodified, the outer or superficial self is constantly developing its experience so that it can never save itself absolutely. I am the same that I was a moment ago. So the deeper self, that Atman, if you will, that supernal self, is unchanging, immutable, oceanic. And this is more like a stream. This is moving from station to station, from moment to moment. And here is the consequence of that. Sri Aurobindo continues, those who live in this surface time self and have not the habit of drawing back inward towards the immutable or the capacity of dwelling in it are even incapable of thinking of themselves apart from this ever self-modifying mental experience. That is for them their self. And it is easy for them, if they look with detachment at its happenings, to agree with the conclusion of the Buddhist nihilists that this self is in fact nothing but a stream of idea and experience and mental action, the persistent flame which is yet never the same flame, and to conclude that there is no such thing as a real self, but only a flow of experience, and behind it, nihil. There is experience of knowledge without a knower, experience of being without an existent. There are simply a number of elements, parts of a flux without a real whole, which combine to create the illusion of a knower and knowledge and the known. The illusion of an existent and existence and the experience of existence. Or they can conclude that time is the only real existence and they themselves are its creatures. This conclusion of an illusory existent in a real or unreal world is as inevitable to this kind of withdrawal as is the opposite conclusion of a real existence, but an illusory world, to the thinker who, dwelling on the immobile self, observes everything else as a mutable not-self. He comes eventually to regard the latter as the result of a deluding trick of consciousness. So, fix your attention. Think yourself to be only this momentary changing element, a construction indeed of elements, and you arrive at the Buddhist view that there is no self, no real self in a world of flux. Have the deeper experience, dwell on the immobile self behind and underneath it all. You might observe all this moving apparent self to be not self. Reject it and say that it is the work of a deluding trickster of Maya. So the Buddhist versus the Advaitin. No self in a world of flux or a real self in an unreal world. But let us look a little at this surface consciousness without theorizing, studying it only in its facts. So if the point of argumentation is the nature of the self bound in phenomena, let's look at it. Let's focus our attention on that and see what elements we can discern. We see it first as a purely subjective phenomenon. There is a constant, rapid shifting of time point which it is impossible to arrest for a moment. There is a constant changing, even when there is no shifting of space circumstance, a change both in the body or form of itself, which the consciousness directly inhabits, and the environing body or form of things in which it less directly lives. So even if you're not involved in movement, there is no stopping the change process. It is equally affected by both, though more vividly, because directly by the smaller than by the larger habitation, by its own body than by the body of the world, because only of the changes in its own body is it directly conscious, and of the body of the world only indirectly, through the senses and the effects of the macrocosm on the microcosm. In other words, something happens in the outer world and it impinges upon us. We sense it, we feel it, we note that there's been a change. But we're minutely aware of everything occurring within us, our changing physical location, the temperature, whether we're happy or not, etc. This change of the body and the surroundings is not so insistently obvious or not so obviously rapid as the swift mutation of time. Yet it is equally real from moment to moment and equally impossible to arrest. But we see that the mental being only regards all this mutation so far as it produces effects upon its own mental consciousness, generates impressions and changes in its mental experience and mental body, because only through the mind can it be aware of its changing physical habitation and its changing world experience. There is an event outside. It has to register. It has to have an impact upon our senses. It has to be interpreted by our mind, pro, con, plus, minus, positive, negative. I like it, I don't like it. Therefore, there is, as well as a shifting or change of time point and space field, a constant modifying change of the sum of circumstances experienced in time and space, and as the result, a constant modification of the mental personality, which is the form of our superficial or apparent self. All this change of circumstance is summed up in philosophical language as causality. For in this stream of the cosmic movement, the antecedent state seems to be the cause of a subsequent state, or else this subsequent state seems to be the result of a previous action of persons, objects, or forces. Yet, in fact, what we call cause may very well be only circumstance. Well, causal, Latin. It refers to what occasions, determines, produces, or conditions an effect. This happens, and that is the result of it. But this idea that it may not, in fact, be truly a cause is reminiscent of the take that David Hume had on the idea of causation. Not quite as strictly discernible as we typically think. Sri Aurobindo continues, thus the mind has over and above its direct self-consciousness a more or less indirect, mutable self-experience, which it divides into two parts. Its subjective experience of the ever-modified mental states of its personality, and its objective experience of the ever-changing environment, which seems partly or wholly to cause and is yet at the same time itself affected by the workings of that personality. But all this experience is at bottom subjective. For even the objective and external is only known to mind in the form of subjective impressions. This is inevitably true. Whatever is out there and is being registered is still interpreted by the agency of the mind or by whatever consciousness perceives and receives those impressions. So here, Sri Aurobindo is describing the apparent mental self. Not the self behind, but that self that we find on the future, up on the surface of things, pardon me. Here, the part played by memory increases greatly in importance. For while all that it can do for the mind with regard to its direct self-consciousness is to remind it that it existed and it was the same in the past as it is in the present, it becomes in our differentiated or surface self-experience an important power linking together past and present experiences, past and present personality, preventing chaos and dissociation, and assuring the continuity of the stream in the surface mind. So memory, in other words, is a storage facility which links past and present experiences through the formality of the mental self. Still, even here, we must not exaggerate the function of memory or ascribe to it that part of the operations of consciousness which really belongs to the activity of other power aspects of the mental being. It is not the memory alone which constitutes the ego sense. Memory is only a mediator between the sense mind and the coordinating intelligence. It offers to the intelligence the past data of experience which the mind holds somewhere within, but cannot carry with it in its running from moment to moment on the surface. So here we have, without direct reference, a picture of the Sankhyan idea of how these things work behind. So there is the apparatus of the senses, subtle and gross, which go out and collect the data of the world. They bring it back. They offer it to the sense mind, what we call manas. The manas offers it to a higher agency, which organizes it in terms of its self-experience, its interpretation of those data within the context of the world. That is the I-sense, the aham, ahamkara, the I-maker. Above that, of course, is the nature of the vaster intelligent will, the buddhi. So Sri Aurobindo is still working within this eons-old insight from Indian psychology, from the great sage Kapila, which is fundamental to all of Indian thought. But back to this analysis of the part that memory plays in this construction of the mind self. A little analysis will make this apparent. We have, in all functionings of the mentality, four elements: the object of mental consciousness, the act of mental consciousness, the occasion, and the subject. So this is interesting. To the earlier reference to the knower, the knowledge, and the known, he has added the element of time in this. In the self-experience of the self-observing inner being, the object is always some state or movement or wave of the conscious being, anger, grief or other emotion, hunger or other vital craving, impulse or inner life reaction, or some form of sensation, perception, or thought activity. That's the object. The act is some kind of mental observation and conceptual valuation of this movement or wave, or else a mental sensation of it in which observation and valuation may be involved and even lost, so that in this act, the mental person may either separate the act and the object by a distinguishing perception or confuse them together indistinguishably. So there's the object, the brute fact of the emotion, and then there's the act, which is the interpretation of that event. That is to say, he may either simply become a movement, let us put it, of angry consciousness, not at all standing back from that activity, not reflecting or observing himself, not controlling the feeling or the accompanying action, or he may observe what he becomes and reflect on it, with this seeing or perception in his mind, I am angry. In the former case, the subject or mental person, the act of conscious self-experience, and the substantial angry becoming of the mind, which is the object of the self-experience, are all rolled up into one wave of conscious force in movement. But in the latter, there is a certain rapid analysis of its constituents, and the act of self-experience partly detaches itself from the object. So in the first, we're consumed by the movement of anger. We just are that anger. In the second, we stand back and say, ah, look at me, I'm angry now. So that means that we have been able to turn our experience into an object which can be viewed from some kind of psychological distance. Some bit of separation, some bit of detachment has occurred. A bifurcation inwardly. Thus, by this act of partial detachment, we are able not only to experience ourselves dynamically in the becoming, in the process of movement of conscious force itself, but to stand back, perceive and observe ourselves, and if the detachment is sufficient, to control our feeling and action, control to some extent our becoming. So we see here then that the conscious being in this element of mentality might confer a power, a volition upon the witnessing agent so that in the experience, one can control the direction of the experience and not simply be the hapless victim experiencing it. He continues, however, there is usually a defect even in this act of self-observation. For there is indeed a partial detachment of the act from the object, but not of the mental person from the mental act. The mental person and the mental action are involved or rolled up in each other. Nor is the mental person sufficiently detached or separated either from the emotional becoming. So there's an identity there. I am aware of myself in an angry becoming of my conscious stuff of being and in a thought perception of this becoming. But all thought perception also is a becoming and not myself. And this I do not yet sufficiently realize. I am identified with my mental activities or involved in them, not free and separate. I do not yet directly become aware of myself apart from my becomings and my perception of them, apart from the forms of active consciousness which I assume in the ways of the sea of conscious force, which is the stuff of my mental and life nature. So even though one has the awareness that I am angry, one still has the identity felt with that thought. That thought is myself, and I am experiencing that. But that is not also the truth. The self is deeper. The thought, again, is an extension of that self, but not the self itself. Got it? Yeah. It is when I entirely detach the mental person from his act of self-experience that I become fully aware first of the sheer ego, and in the end, of the witness self or the thinking mental person, the something or someone who becomes angry and observes it, but is not limited or determined in his being by the anger or the perception. you can see, is followed all the way here, the Sankhya chain of being, senses delivering data to an organizing sense mind, manas. The manas delivering what it's made sense of from it to the experience of the self, the I am the maker. And so the ego gathers all of that and then presents that to the thinker, the buddhi. And then behind that, that's the real self. So climbing step by step, we get back to the experience of the real person, the purusha. And in the end of the witness self or the thinking mental person, manomaya purusha, the something or someone who becomes angry and observes it, but is not limited or determined in his being by the anger or the perception. He is, on the contrary, a constant factor, aware of an unlimited succession of conscious movements and conscious experiences of movements, and aware of his own being in that succession. But he can be aware of it also behind that succession, supporting it, containing it, always the same in fact of being and force of being beyond the changing forms or arrangements of his conscious force. He is thus the self that is immutably, and at the same time the self that becomes eternally in the succession of time. It is the same self that forever is in its oceanic static being, and involves itself in the succession of time which goes on forever. You can see that his constant referring to conscious being, conscious force, he is at play here with the terminology of theistic Vedanta's concept of Satchit Ananda, which will appear in the next paragraph again, without reference. So, it is evident that there are not really two selves, but one conscious being, which throws itself up in the waves of conscious force so as to experience itself in a succession of changing movements of itself, by which it is not really changed, increased, or diminished, any more than the original stuff of matter or energy in the material world is increased or diminished by the constantly changing combinations of the elements, although it seems to be changed to the experiencing consciousness, so long as it lives only in the knowledge of the phenomenon and does not get back to the knowledge of the original being, substance, or force. And a phenomenon is what is a directly apprehended event. Here, there is a more essential self, of which the phenomenal is only, again, an extension or attribution in terms of nature. But always there is this sat-chit, this existence consciousness, which expresses itself as consciousness force, chit shakti, and in the seeking finds experience, which is to it a play of delight. And Sri Aurobindo continues, when it does get back to that deeper knowledge, it does not condemn the observed phenomenon as unreal, but it perceives an immutable being, energy, or real substance, not phenomenal, not subject in itself to the senses. It sees at the same time a becoming or real phenomenon of that being, energy, or substance. This becoming we call phenomenon because, actually, as things are with us now, it manifests itself to the consciousness under the conditions of sense perception and sense relation and not directly to the consciousness itself in its pure and unconditioned embracing and totally comprehending knowledge. So we're not capable, we don't yet grasp, living in a mental self, the whole, but only a part, a phenomenon, not the entire flow. So, with the self, it is immutably to our direct self-consciousness. It manifests itself mutably in various becomings to the mind sense and the mental experience. Therefore, as things are with us now, not directly to the pure, unconditioned knowledge of the consciousness, but to it, under the conditions of our mentality, this much of its real being it can transmit to the limited agency of mind, which is stuck in the phenomenal flow of things and can't see the larger context or the real self which underlies all. It is this succession of experiences, and it is this fact of an indirect or secondary action of the experiencing consciousness under the conditions of our mentality that bring in the device of memory. Something has to link these successions of experiences for us all, and memory does it. For a primary condition of our mentality is division by the moments of time. There is an inability to get its experience or to hold its experiences together except under the conditions of this self-division by the moments of time. In the immediate mental experience of a wave of becoming, a conscious movement of being, there is no action or need of memory. I become angry. It is an act of sensation, not of memory. I observe that I am angry. It is an act of perception, not of memory. Memory only comes in when I begin to relate my experience to the successions of time, when I divide my becoming into past, present, and future. When I say, I was angry a moment ago, or I have become angry and am still in anger, or I was angry once and will be again if there is the same occasion. Memory may indeed come immediately and directly into the becoming if the occasion of the movement of consciousness is itself wholly or partly a thing of the past. For example, if there is a recurrence of emotion, such as grief or anger, caused by memory of past wrong or suffering, and not by any immediate occasion in the present, or else caused by an immediate occasion reviving the memory of a past occasion. Because we cannot keep the past in us on the surface of the consciousness, though it is always there behind, within, subliminally present, and often even active, therefore, we have to recover it as something that is lost or is no longer existent. And this we do by that repetitive and linking action of the thought mind, which we call memory, just as we summon things which are not within the actual field of our limited superficial mind experience, by the action of the thought mind, which we call imagination, that greater power in us and high summoner of all possibilities, realizable or unrealizable, into the field of our ignorance. So he has reached a point where I think you can see that he has established the case that memory as an agency or utility of the mind, so that it can link past experiences to the present and reach towards the future, cannot be the thing which defines or substantiates the nature even of the surface self, of the ego, let's say. It's insufficient for even that. Its role is more limited. And this is contra to some thinking which in past philosophy has regarded the personality is largely the construct and preserve of memory, that the ego could be equated with memory. Sri Aurobindo, I think, has established, even with this much of his argument, that that cannot be so. And of course, his greater argument is that there is a greater self, of which the phenomenal play through the mind is only a surface appearance. Always, that real self is eternal. Conscious being at play with itself in the flow of nature, the phenomena of time and the circumstance and space, but also ever resting within its deep sea of bliss and delight, within, unmanifested, immaculate, immutable. So it is and it becomes. So we'll leave it there. This week we'll finish the chapter next week. Don't get used to going through these chapters in only 2 weeks. We have some long ones again in front of us. But the balance of memory, ego, and self-experience we'll reserve for next week. And I'm, as always, looking for passages in Savitri which are relevant to our reading in the Life Divine. And I think I found something that will be pertinent this time in the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds. That's Book 2. In Canto 11, Kingdoms and Godheads of the Greater Mind. In a sublimer and more daring soar to the wide summit of the triple stairs, bare steps climbed up like flaming rocks of gold, burning their way to a pure, absolute sky. August and few, the sovereign kings of thought, have made of space their wide, all-seeing gaze, surveying the enormous work of time. A breath of all-containing consciousness supported being in a still embrace. Intercessors with a luminous unseen, they capped in the long passage to the world the imperatives of the Creator Self, obeyed by unknowing earth, by conscious heaven. Their thoughts are partners in its vast control. A great all-ruling consciousness is there, and mind unwitting serves a higher power. It is a channel, not the source of all. The cosmos is no accident in time. There is a meaning in each play of chance. There is a freedom in each face of fate. A wisdom knows and guides the mysteried world. A truth gaze shapes its beings and events. A word self-born upon creation's heights, voice of the eternal in the temporal spheres, prophet of the seeings of the absolute, sows the idea's significance and form, and from that seeing the growths of time arise. On peaks beyond our ken, the all-wisdom sits. A single and infallible look comes down, a silent touch from the supernal's air, awakes to ignorant knowledge in its acts, the secret power in the inconscient depths, compelling the blinded Godhead to emerge, determining necessity's nude dance as she passes through the circuit of the hours and vanishes from the chase of finite eyes down circling vistas of aeonic time. The unseizable forces of the cosmic whirl bear in their bacchant limbs the fixity of an original foresight that is fate. Even nature's ignorance is truth's instrument. Our struggling ego cannot change her course. Yet is it a conscious power that moves in us? A seed idea is parent of our acts, and destiny the unrecognized child of will. So, we'll reconvene then next week and finish our chapter. Namaste. Jai Ma.